Your digital library experience. Podcasts from algoafm.co.za.
Child Protection Week happens every week from the 25th of May to the 5th of June, and it really is a time to highlight the silent pandemic of child sexual abuse and rape, which is devastating young lives. There are other ways in which children are not being protected, but I think these are the ones that are, you know, very significant in South Africa. And this year, the theme is Every Conversation Matters, Shifting Conversation into Action. So we're looking at how this demands more than just awareness. It's about how to protect children, dismantle harmful narratives, and restore dignity.
In the opening line of the email that I have, information-wise, it says, the hidden pandemic of child sexual abuse in South Africa and how shame, silence, and stigma are failing our children. Those are very bleak terms. Are there statistics available that can kind of paint the picture a little more clearly for people?
If we start with systemic failure, it has been our experience. We aren't actually an organization for child rape or sexual assault. We work with orphans and vulnerable children. So this is, you know, what we have gathered as we've helped some of the children that are within our programs. But it turns out that as little as 3 in 100 cases actually result in trial when it comes to child rape. That's what experts have come up with. And there is so much that goes into that. It's very traumatic for children going forward and reporting this. And very often it almost seems as if it's easier for the offender than the victim. So that's in terms of systemic failures. It just feels that there's terrible failure in terms of police, how that operates, and then actually getting to court and getting dates and having all the evidence in line. So that's incredibly challenging. DNA takes years to get back, so it's a very ongoing, prolonged process, which then deters a lot of people from reporting. There are many damaging stigmas out there. I think a lot of this conversation starts with us, you know, kind of asking ourselves, what do we think when we hear that somebody has been sexually abused or raped? Because so often there has been this kind of narrative that was something done to invite this, or, you know, was there some fault on the victim's part? Messages around boys can't be raped, and we have come across the fact that is absolutely untrue. We've had a number of boys being raped within our realm, and this is horrifically underreported. And then, you know, silence.
I'd like to come back to that stat, and just to get clarity from you. Are you saying of 100 reported incidents, only 3 result in a trial? And even then, underreporting must be a factor too?
Yes. That's what the evidence that we've come across.
That is heartbreakingly startling.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah.
Okay. So, as we were saying, the fact that yes, you would say, I've been shot or I've been robbed, but yet you might actually stop yourself from getting any kind of closure or taking it any further if it was a case of male rape. But let's just talk very quickly, if we can, and I hope that this is something that you can speak to. One of the first kind of subtopics here is breaking the silence, how families and communities can respond when a child discloses abuse. Mm-hmm. I'd like to add to that, are there any signs of abuse that we can look out for that aren't necessarily physical?
Absolutely. I think when a child is showing a sudden change in behavior, or, you know, teachers are saying there's been, you know, your child is behaving differently, that is very often a sign that something has happened. So just sudden changes of behavior, changes of, you know, appetite, or not sleeping well, extra tearfulness that aren't easily, explained, would definitely be something to look out for. And, yeah, in terms of how families and communities can respond, I think, you know, we feel that those first few seconds when a child comes to disclose are so actually imperative in how they will process and cope in the long term. So if they, when a traumatic event, there are often 3 key things at play that make it become a traumatic event. And that is a sense of feeling unsafe, feeling alone or isolated or disconnected, and not having any control or feeling overpowered. So when a child comes to us it's so important for all, you know, parents, adults, educators, whoever we are in that circumstance, to first assure the child that they're safe. Secondly, to allow them to speak about what's happened, and you know, without any shred of disbelief or questioning that could be jarring to them, it's almost to allow them to feel that we're with them in it as they recount it, because that takes away that sense of them having been disconnected in the traumatic event. And then to look at what they can do to start to regain a sense of control. It could be something as simple as taking deep breaths, or, you know, anything that they can go, this is what I want to do, or this is what I need to do. Bearing in mind also that we have to understand that this little body carries potentially important evidence, and so to not do anything that could remove or complicate that.
Yes, I understand. All of those make sense. The problem is when a child says something as startling as that, I imagine the vast majority of adults would default to some form of disbelief. And as you say, the first couple seconds in this interaction are absolutely key.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, this theme this year is so good. It's that every conversation matters, and it's all the conversations that we're having ongoingly as adults about this, and challenging things that are said that we believe and that we might hear in conversations that might contribute to us carrying a kind of innate sense to disbelieve or to be shocked. And it's totally understandable to be shocked when such a thing comes to light, but to just be so clear with the children that we're shocked because we're hurting for them, or shocked because of what we've heard, and not because of any fault of their own, or, you know, anything that they've done wrong.
Right.
So there is such a shameful nature to this whole thing, that we've got to be extra careful not to contribute to that in any way.
Yeah. That's the next subtopic. Shame must change sides. Why shifting blame from victims to perpetrators is critical for healing.
Yeah. So as I said, it's so sad that crimes of this nature are treated so differently to others, which, you know, by default then can allow this shameful or guilt experience to take place. This line, shame must change sides, actually came from a landmark case in France last year with a woman who had been raped for many years at the hands of her husband with other men. Yes. And when asked, would she like to remain anonymous, or, you know, protect the anonymity of the people in the case, she said, absolutely not. I've done nothing wrong. My rapist has, and shame must change sides. And this phrase has gained, you know, global momentum. And we said that is good and very powerful in creating a new narrative. So that's why we felt it was such a good kind of tagline to go with this time, to just ensure that if there's nothing else we can control, that we will not allow the victims of these crimes to remain trapped in shame and guilt and silence.
I suppose if the crime has such an intimate nature, it really is a violation on a scale you can't comprehend, because it's somebody who, we're talking children here, people who don't know completely yet how their body works, there's plenty of information missing, and they've been forced into the most adult of acts against their will. That I understand results then in the unspoken trauma of male victims, as they say, and we need to dismantle the myth that boys can't be raped.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, from trauma to transformation, the long-term impact of unprocessed abuse and why early intervention matters. I think that's self-explanatory, but if we could expand on that a little, perhaps?
Yes. You know, whenever trauma isn't assisted, there are hugely increased risks of things like depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies, poor school performance. So often school marks just plummet, and then there's, you know, all those compounding issues of lack of confidence, and especially if all of this is in secret and silence and nobody's understanding what's going on. Relational challenges that come about as a result of unprocessed trauma, especially in this regard. And in some really tragic instances, we see the victims becoming perpetrators themselves. And we have sadly come across cases of young boys as offenders in our spheres.
Who started off as victims?
We really believe that they have, you know, either been witness to things that are traumatic or they can't make sense of, or have been, you know, exposed to terrible narratives around that this is what masculinity looks like, or in the case that we've come across, that they themselves have been victims. And because they haven't been able to process in a healthy way and be assisted with their trauma and overcoming that, they turn to playing it out themselves.
Then the big one, of course, empowering a generation. How can we raise children who are not only protected but equipped to protect others? In other words, we're looking to the future now because we are acknowledging a fairly horrible current.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously, you know, first part in all of this is prevention. And prevention is so much easier when there's good education around this. So with the children, we have about 400 orphans and vulnerable children who come to our program. So, for example, this week we're doing lessons on educating them about the different types of abuse. And in this, we have to be so careful to be clear. I'll give you an example. We will talk about that adults shouldn't touch you in your private parts, you know, the parts that are covered by underwear.
Right.
And yet, you might have parents who need to wash or assist children if they've had an accident or just with bath routines. And so we don't want to in any way contribute to kind of false cases being reported. So we sit as a team and we really wrestle with how can we do this responsibly. So, for example, we'll say it might be classified as sexually inappropriate if there's something secretive about it or it's hurting you. Or if an adult is bathing or changing you and you feel that they would do something different if somebody else walked into the room, then that is probably problematic. So we just we really talk through the various scenarios, and so education is key. And we talk about the various types of abuse, and we're very clear to say, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to schools and talk about child protection to the children. But child protection starts with adults. It is our role to protect children.
Obviously,
and we're very clear about saying to the children, it is not your responsibility to protect yourself or others. You can do things to stay safe. And you certainly can notice if there's a child that you feel who isn't being protected or is being abused, that you can do what you feel is within your safe realm to do something to help that child. So with them understanding the various forms of abuse and the channels of help that are available, we feel that we can do a significant amount to prevent cases and then for children to be a part of assisting one another if needed, to get them to the right adults who can help them overcome.
Quite a number of years ago already, I hosted a weekly talk show with a clinical sexologist, and we kind of divided the kind of Thursdays, it was on a Thursday evening of the month, up to focusing one on children, one on relationships, one on this, and then one kind of general. And the saying that we kind of had at the time when it came to sex ed for children is 8 is too late, because as is being said, if you don't teach your children, then someone who does not necessarily have their best interests really might.
Absolutely. And you know, this is so important, and especially in our communities where it's kind of it's almost shunned to talk about sex. It's so important if we can talk about sex as being a good natural gift, and being able to speak about private parts with the proper terminology. And it's okay to also have, you know, kind of, you know, in childish terms or infantilized terms, but it's also important that they know the proper names of such things. And to speak about it, I mean, I really looked at a friend of mine who always just had books that were about sex out on the bookshelf. And as her children could, you know, pick them up, there was no shame about them. They were there and they could ask questions and satisfy their curiosity with getting answers. And I think it's so important for all of us to look at how we, you know, inadvertently making it a shameful thing without any intention, just because of our own discomfort. So it really does start with us to make sure that our children and those within our realms of influence hear about it in a positive way. Like you say, before they get to be exposed to it through, you know, dirty images or, so you know, what's on each other's cell phones. So that they can kind of imprint in a healthy way on what it should be and thereby be able to know when it's unhealthy and not good.
Yeah. I hope to some extent the chat that we've just had has covered a little ground of kind of saying what needs to happen to change from where we are now to where we should be. I've been talking to Natalie Nordier, who's the Empowerment Manager at ReStory Foundation, about Child Protection Week, the theme this year, Every Conversation Matters, Shifting Conversation to Action. You and I have had a conversation. I hope it results in some action.
Thank you so much, Charles. It's been great to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
Your Digital Library Experience. Podcasts from algoafm.co.za.